So this evening, I like to look at, in a way, the title of this retreat, which was Letting Go in Four Stages. And so this is an idea that came to me over time about this letting go. That, as we have already mentioned, often we have the impression that letting go is let go, stop, eradicate, destroy, don't consider. But personally, I like to look at letting go in a much wider way and to see that there is not one type of letting go, but that actually there are different types of letting go, and in a way one is not better than the other. But it's just that there are different moments where... So I think, in a way, often with this idea of letting go, at getting rid of something. And personally, I really don't see it that way. I would see it more as creatively engaging, not destroying something, but creatively engaging with what arises. But here I want to show that there are different types of letting go, and each is as important as the other, so that there is not like a special letting go that we're going for. And then you have little minors letting go, but they're not that great. We want the big one. But personally, I think they're all important. They're all very useful. And I think at different time, we will have these different, what I call stages, these different types of letting go. And so the first one might appear to be a strange one, because here I'm looking tonight as letting go in terms of the habits, in terms of cycle, in terms of trigger, of conditioning, of reactivity. And so in terms of that, we have the impression with our habits, that it be mental habits, physical habits, emotional habit, relationship habit, we have the impression that they're quite automatic, that there is a saying in Korea where they say, I cannot help it. You know, I cannot stop myself from doing this. I cannot stop myself from reacting this way. And often with our habits, we have this kind of lots of good intention, you know, and we think, it's not a good idea to do that. And then you do it again and you think, why am I doing this again? Even though it's not a good idea, even though it's painful. And the thing with this automaticity is the fact that it's kind of like an impulse. It's like it takes us over. It's nearly like it has a life of its own. So it's nearly like we're blind to it. And so I would say the first stage actually is recognizing, oh yeah, this happened and now it's finished. And so for me, one of the stages of letting go is going through reactivity. It's really experiencing getting lost, getting it wrong, overreacting, being overwhelmed. And then at some point, it stops. Because like all things, reactivity stops too. Because the condition dissipates, we start to be more calm, we start to see more clearly. And then we can see, oh, I was caught. And to me, that is starting the first stage of letting go, is realizing that we were caught, and now I am not caught anymore. Now I am not experiencing the reactivity. I am not experiencing the upsetness or the anger or whatever it might be, or the confusion. And so to see that we need to have that, because often what happens is that we go into reactivity, we have an automatic pattern. It stops because it has to stop, to things have to change. But then we don't notice it, and we reproduce it again and again and again. So the first stage is actually to see it. Oh, I was caught. But now it's finished. And this is a letting go. The fact that now we're not so identified with it. Because when we caught in it, we totally believe it. That this is my right to be as angry as I want. This is my, I cannot help it, or whatever we say. We're really caught. But I think it's very important, that moment where we see, oh, I was caught. But now I am not caught anymore. And in the tradition I practiced at the beginning, which is a Son tradition in Korea, the Zen tradition, they say that defilement are awakening. That you're not going to find the awakening outside of the proliferation, outside of the reactivity. That awakening is not somewhere else. Then actually in the midst of our difficulty, in the midst of our automatic reaction. But the first step to awakening is to recognize, oh, I was caught. Now I can see it. And because I can see it, I am not caught anymore. So in a way, I think we have to accept that part of the letting go is not actually to get rid of the pattern, but to really recognize the pattern, to really notice, oh, this happened and I really reacted and I was really upset or whatever it might be. And now it has run its course. And now it's not existing anymore, even if it existed before. And so I think there is an important step of recognizing that we have a tendency to do certain things, but that we actually do not do it all the time. That I think is very important. So in a way, these four stages of letting go, I have given them some names. And that first stage is after. After you go through the whole cycle, it stops. And then you can look back. And then you can reflect. And then you can bring, in a way, some clarity to what happened. Even if in that moment you were not clear, it doesn't mean that afterward you cannot be clear about it. And so for me, this is a letting go, because some clarity emerged, because something stopped. And in that stopping, in a way, there is a clarity that can emerge. So in a way, I would look at this stage after as, in a way, see and learn. See and learn. We have to learn from our reactivity. We have to learn from our pattern. Because if we don't see them, how they activated, how they manifest, then we cannot creatively engage with them. So that's what, in a way, this stage is about. See and learn. Because in a way, I think what the problem with the habit is really the blindness. When we caught in them and we don't see that we've done something. And to me, this is so interesting. You do something and it has an impact and you're not aware that you've done it. That, I think, is very problematic. If we say something to somebody or if we act in a certain way and we don't see it because we're too locked in, we're too identified with it. And so this is already a movement when you can see, oh, I did not see it then and I was really caught in it. And because I was really caught in it, I was hurtful, I was harmful, I said things I regret or whatever it might be. And then you can, I did it. I said this. This was harmful. This was painful for myself, for others. So in a way, personally, each time you have a letting go, you have two things that happens together. One is that there is more compassion, which can arise, because when we're blind, there is no compassion for ourselves, for others. That's the thing, when we're blind to our habits, then it actually covers any clarity and it covers compassion. And so in a way, the letting go of after is suddenly some clarity can appear and some compassion for yourself, for others, can appear. Then you have the next one, and the next one I call during. And so this you are, there have been some trigger, there have been some contributing factor and condition, and so you react. And so you become angry, upset, anxious, fearful, whatever it is. And because you've practiced meditation, because you practice mindfulness, now you are aware of it. So you're not blind anymore. But what is very, this stage, I think, is the most frustrating. Because you're very aware, and that doesn't seem to make a difference. And so at least before you could enjoy it, you know, you could enjoy being angry or whatever. Now you can't enjoy it anymore. So you're like, And it's kind of like you want it not to happen. So in a way, you would prefer if not to be angry or frightful or anxious or whatever it is. And actually, it's just there. It's so there. And then you think, this mindfulness, it's not fun. It's not fun. It was supposed to make this disappear. It was supposed to poof. And on the contrary, and I think this actually is an important stage of letting go. That when we're in the middle of it, we really know it. Because the thing, when we reactive in this automatic way, is that we generally get very caught in the story of it, in the abstraction of it, in the meaning of it, in the association with it. And actually, the mindfulness is helping us to see how does it feel in the whole body and mind. How does it feel to be anxious, to be fearful, to be angry, to be jealous, to be worried? How does it feel? And there, I think, one of the key is really to really own it fully in the experience. How does it feel in the mind, in the body, in the heart? And so in a way, this stage of letting go is very important. It's not fun. I'm not saying it's fun. But I think it's very important. So in a way, we can really know for ourselves fully, what is the experience of reacting in that way? Because as long as it's abstract, as long as it's caught in story, actually we'll just amplify it. And I think this is, to me, the letting go of that moment of during is the fact that by being aware, being mindful, fully of what's going on, it starts to dissolve the amplification. It starts to dissolve the this is me. And instead, it becomes an exploration. How does it feel? And to me, this was really a revelation, because I used to have a tendency to be irritable and to get angry. And then one day, I had this discussion with another Buddhist, so it was very peaceful discussion. But very resentful too, you know. And he was like, you know, you never done it, I will do it, I promise, but you've never done it. And so what was interesting is that, you know, we did not shout at each other, but we were kind of standing on our position. And then I had to work for a conference. And so I was cooking. And so I had to leave the discussion, come argument. And as I was cutting vegetable for the meal, I suddenly find myself cutting carrots like that. And I thought, this is a little dangerous, you know, to cut carrots in that state. So I said, okay, what is it I'm experiencing right now? But not the story of it, how I felt. And what I felt was my whole body was like that. My whole body was shaking. But I realized I was doing it. She did not do it. She did not make my body shake. I was doing the shaking. I was creating the shaking. And I thought, but this is painful. Do I want to continue the shaking? I thought, not really. And as soon as I saw it was my own shaking, it just went. Because I was really able to see it in situ, experiencing it in the body, instead of, in a way, a story in the mind. And then, because it was painful, I could say, I don't want to grasp at this. This is painful. Why? Why grasp at fire? You can let the fire go by itself. And then I looked in the mind. And in the mind, I was going, I am right, she is wrong. I am right, she is wrong. And then I thought, she must be doing the same, but in the opposite way. I am right, she is wrong. And I thought, we both right and wrong. And again, it went. Because I really, in a way, looked at the manifestation of it. And that, to me, that's why this stage is very important. Because it's kind of, and that's why I know this mindfulness of being mindful of the breath, of the sound, of the body, you think, you know, nothing is happening, and, you know, I sit there, and this feeling tone, where is it anyway, underneath the cushion, or I cannot find anything. But actually, of course, here, hopefully not much is going on, because it's hopefully fairly peaceful. So what you're going to experience is more neutral. But then it's a good entry point to when we go back in daily life, where we have lots of things happening, things are more intense, then it's a way to become used to be with the sensation, with the sound, with the breath, and get more familiar with this kind of mindfulness. Because in a way, we have to train ourselves. And so generally, it's not so good to jump in the fire immediately. Generally, it's okay, the breath, sensation, And then we get become more familiar with being with what arises. And then when we are in daily life, when something arises, which is much more potent, much more intense, then we can move towards it a little more easily if we train at a lighter level first. So that's what we're doing in a way. When what we do here is training at a lighter level. So we kind of train at this level again and again and again. Not much is happening, but still we train. And then in daily life, we can use it for things which are a little more intense, which are a little more in your face. And then we can learn to be with it and not immediately go into the abstraction of it or the story of it, but how does it feel in my body? Is it the same all the time? This is, again, I think it's very important with the letting go, the changing. Does it remain the same? Does it change? How is this trembling? Where do I feel it more? What am I thinking? What am I telling myself? This, I think, is really important. I know you're sitting in meditation here and a lot of you might think, but I keep having all these thoughts. And I would tell you, this is information. This is really information. To see, what is it I think? How do I think it? How does that influence me? Because we so quickly taken over by our ideas, our thought, our story, that we become like totally immersed. And here we can start to, wait a minute, I'm telling this to myself. And that's why often I would bring a question to our thought. You're telling yourself something, is it true? I mean, it could be true or not. But often we have the feeling, because it's in my head, it's true. Not necessarily. So in a way, with the exploration, also looking, what's going on now? Not so much, why am I experiencing this? No. But what am I experiencing? What am I thinking? How am I thinking? What's the language? What's the tone? What am I saying? And is this true? So I would see this second stage of during, of really know fully what is going on. That this actually is a letting go too, to know fully our state, mental state, emotional state, physical state, just to know it, just in a way to access it, to meet it. And in that way, again, embracing our suffering, embracing our difficulty, that we're not going to find awakening outside of that. There was this, long ago, there was a Chinese master who I used to correspond with people who worked in a government in China in the 12th century. And so there is this fellow who writes letters about his practice. And so the fellow says, oh, I have such a hard time practicing, and I am so dim and dull. And and then what does the master say? The master says, the person who sees dim and dull is not dim and dull. So in ways to see when we are in the middle and we see something, actually we are activating wisdom, we're activating clarity, we're activating mindfulness. So that actually letting go, I would say, is being mindful. That generally being mindful brings a certain level of letting go within it. And then we have the next stage. And the next stage is at the beginning. And here, we kind of start to have, I would say, more and more wisdom. And one of the wisdom we start to have is not to identify. So that we, instead of saying, I am an angry person, I'm always angry, I'm always anxious, or I'm always fearful, or whatever it is, we start to see that I am not always like that. But it happens. This is what is interesting with pattern, is that they are repetitive, definitely, but they're not happening all the time. They're not happening every minute, every hour, every day, every week. They happen time to time. And then that's why I think it's very important, the exploration, that we start to see what is a trigger, what are the conditions, and what is a contributing factor. And so as we said this morning, we cannot know everything. But we can start to have a little an inkling of how the reactivity works. That generally you have a little trigger, then you have some contributing factor, like generally stress, tiredness, not sleeping so well. And then you also have other conditions that might come in. And so this stage of letting go is actually knowing that I don't always react this way, but then to start to know what are the conditions, what are the contributing factors which will lead me to react in that way. And then here, this stage is about what can I do to help myself? Because here, you have still the power of the habit. I think in a way, when we do the meditation, we have to see that actually what we cultivate is a power of the mindfulness over time. So again, we sit here, we walk in meditation, we think not much is happening, I still have all these thoughts, I'm not sleepy, I mean, you know, I'm not going to go anywhere. But actually, each time you come back, each time you see, each time you try to be mindful, you are building power. You are building the power of meditative awareness, the power of creative mindfulness. And that power is what, in a way, we need to build up over time to slightly offset the power of the habits. Because the problem with the habit is that we repeat them. So we do it once, we do it again, we do it again. So in a way, the more we do it, it's nearly the more likely we're going to do it again. Because we build, in a way, kind of a certain energy, a certain power to the habit. And so that's why we have to be careful and to think, well, you know, I do a week of meditation, or I've been meditating for 2 or 3 years, and, you know, my habit should just go. But I mean, your habit generally have been building up for 20 years or 30 years. So they have a certain momentum behind them. And so in a way, what we're doing on a retreat is building nearly the opposite momentum of the mindfulness. But also to see that what we're also doing with the anchoring is to bring back the creative functioning. That all the habits are actually survival mechanism. And that we need to bring back to creative functioning. So in a way we have to see when is it creative functioning and when is it kind of like automatic habit, which is not going to be helpful, which is going to be harmful. And so that third stage of at the beginning is really we start to know, oh, in this condition, this is going to happen, or it's more likely to happen. So how can I help myself? I think we can help ourselves in two ways. Either help ourselves in advance. This is what I learned to do with taking a lot of airplane. And I used to be a little frazzled in airport. And then if I was a little frazzled, I was a little unpleasant. And I would speed up and everything. And then I thought, how can I help myself? And so various things, but bringing enough things to read, etc., etc. So now I have kind of thing in place. So when I am in an airport, generally I'm fine because I've kind of understood what triggers me, what are the contributing factors. Then I try to help myself with that. So this is part of the third letting go, is how can I prepare myself to meet difficult situation. Also, the next thing is if I meet the difficult situation, which will trigger me, and if there are other contributing factors, how can I help myself? And this is by doing something. So here we have to be careful of seeing often letting go equanimity as not doing anything. Personally, I don't feel this. I feel there is part of the practice which is actually very active, very creative. How can I help myself here? Because as the Buddha was saying yesterday, if you continue in that vein, you're going to a very difficult place. So what can you do which is going to, in a way, change the direction? And I think this is something we have to consider. Also with feeling tone, as I was mentioning this morning, you can accentuate the feeling tone, which is then going to make you act or say things in a certain way. Or how can I diminish the feeling tone? How can I, what is it I can do to help myself? So as part of this research I'm doing in France, I'm helping. I became part of the little study, guinea pig study, where they needed 10 people who had done 10,000 hours of meditation. I mean, I don't know how they counted them, but anyway, we are supposed to have done a lot of meditation. And then they wanted us to go through the machine, the fMRI, the PET scan, to see, you know, what's the effect of the meditation on their brain and on their memory? I mean, I could have told them, forget about the memory, but anyway. Anyway, so, and the thing is that I had never been in an fMRI. I had never been in a PET scan. But everybody thought she's been meditating her 10,000 hours. It will be a piece of cake to do that. So we go to the fMRI machine, and I'm not even in the tube. They just put around my neck this thing of, you know, it's kind of like a molding thing around your neck. And I start to hyperventilate. I am not even in the machine. I'm already... And my whole body is saying, no way, we're not doing this. So obviously, there were some problems. We look at each other. Guinea pig is not so good. 10,000 hours not helping. So okay, I try to calm myself down. All right. So I lie down again. They put this thing around my neck, and I can feel the whole body, my whole body is saying, this is really bad. This is, you know, I hyperventilate like that. And I think, okay, we're going to do this, we're going to do this. So I said, okay, let's go in the machine. And so I am in the machine. And my whole body is going, get out, get out. I want to get out, I want to get out. And I have to stay in there about 30 minutes, 30 to 40 minutes. And I'm already feeling I don't want to be there. My body is saying, no way, we're not doing this. So I thought, okay, what can I do? And then I did everything. I did the questioning meditation. I did the listening meditation. I did the being aware of the breath meditation. And I was telling myself, you can do it. You can do it. You can do it. You can do it. And I was feeling, you can do it. Sound, breath. What is this? What is this? What is it? Everything. So I put everything in the basket. And actually it took 15 minutes. 15 minutes of just total doing everything. And then poof, it was gone. Then it was like I was in nirvana. I was like floating. And I was totally fine. But in order to reach that stage of being totally fine, I had to do everything. Everything in my toolkit. Because my mind was okay, but my body was not. My body was really not into it. Because it felt it could not breathe properly. And so to me, what was interesting here is that I should have been equanimous. My body should not have reacted. But it was not so. Because you had different factors coming together. And then I had to do something in a way to change the situation, to dissolve the intensity. And so that third stage is really about that, understanding the conditions and what is it I can do. Sometimes it is like me, what is the most I can do because I need it all? Or sometimes it, what is the least I can do here to help myself? So I think here we have to be careful because often we think, what is the most I can do? What I would say is, at this stage, what is the least you can do? You think, I cannot do anything, but what is the least you can do? And generally, there is a little something you can do to change the orientation. So this stage is really about understanding and doing something. And then you have the fourth stage. And the fourth stage is before. And this is when you really build up the power of the creative awareness, of the mindfulness. And then you see yourself on the point of going into the pattern. So you have the hole, the trigger, the contributing factor, everything is there. And normally, you take an over. But then, because of the power of the awareness, you think, do I have to react in that automatic way? Because generally it's like, we kind of like, it's an impulse and we take an over. So generally there is no space to say, wait a minute, I don't want to go there. And so in a way, the mindfulness is giving us that choice, is giving us that space to say, wait a minute, normally I react in that way to protect myself, to survive. Could I do something different? And what is interesting at this point is that we experience a great fear. And in a way, why don't we change? We are afraid of the unknown. So in a way, we prefer the pain of the known than the non-pain of the unknown. And I think what the power of the creative awareness gives us is a push to say, even if I don't know, I'll try it. I'll do something different for once. And if we do something different, we experience a great peace. And then we think, but why didn't I do it before? It's so easy not to do this, actually, and to do something else. It's so easy. And it's because of that fear of the unknown. And then what is interesting is that then the pattern is really gone because we cannot do it anymore because of compassion. I think a lot of the time, a lot of our patterns are survival mechanisms. So they get put into place over time to protect us, from harm, because this is a way we've helped ourselves to navigate certain situations, even though we don't need to do that anymore. And so, in a way, because it has served us, it has been useful in the past, we think, oh, I can't drop it. It's kind of like a protection. But actually, with the creative awareness, we see that the pattern is generally painful for us, but also painful for others. And then we can have this creative letting go of, okay, I don't want to be hurt. And at the same time, I don't want to hurt somebody else. So how can I creatively engage in this situation? And so to me, this is in a way, again, that component in the letting go, that the letting go is not cutting off, is not being indifferent, but it's actually the letting go is having more compassion, more wise compassion for ourselves, more wise compassion for others. And then through that wise compassion, we start to think, oh, how can I creatively engage with somebody who is difficult? How can I creatively engage when I feel stressed, when I am tired, when I don't understand? And then you can start to, again, what is the different thing I can do? We can explore. Instead of being stuck in something that we know, but which is not so helpful anymore. So it's kind of really starting to open to what I would call a creative exploration. So it's not getting rid of something, but it's finding another way to be within that situation. And so what is important to see with these four stages of after, during, at the beginning, before, is that they're not better than the other. For me, they all have their places as moment of letting go. And according to different things, we might be before, and there is certain thing we will never do again. And then other thing, we'll do them again and again. And we sometimes will see them after we've done it. We'll see them in the middle of it. I mean, nowadays, I'm taking care of my mother, who is losing her memory. And so sometimes this can be a little frustrating. And what I found interesting is that sometimes, because it's frustrating, I have this unpleasant feeling tone which comes up. And then there is that little voice which tells me, you can be angry, you should be angry. You have the right to be angry. It's frustrating, isn't it? So I kind of feel the feeling tone, I feel the story, and I feel, but why? What would be the point? This would not help the situation whatsoever. Because if I raise my voice, my mom is like, and she's not going to kind of, it's not going to improve. And so for me, it's very interesting to see that. You get the unpleasant feeling tone, then you get the righteousness. Yes. Then you feel, wait. But I can see how it's seductive. Yeah. It's my right. Interesting. Why should it be my right? Because I have an unpleasant feeling tone to react to it. I don't necessarily have to. But it's interesting what the construction is. And so part of the letting go is seeing the construction. That's why I'm so interested in the feeling tone, noticing the feeling tone. Then what's built up on top of it. And then just see, oh yeah, that comes together. Do I want to act on it? Do I want to identify with it? Not necessarily. But it doesn't mean I am not going to experience an unpleasant feeling too. But I will not amplify it. So I think part of the letting go, a big part, I think of this, all these stages of letting go, is in a way as de-amplification device. So what we're doing here, the mindfulness, where not much seems to be happening, or nothing at all, is actually very small, de-amplifying. We're kind of learning to de-amplify. Can we be with what is going on without adding anything to it? So it's kind of that movement. We have this tendency to add, and then it's, do I need to? Do I choose to? Or do I just creatively engage? So that's what I wanted to say. So are there any questions or comments? Yes.
Do you have any thoughts about, or like emotions like pride and shame, for example, are they defilements, or are they, can they be useful, or how could we creatively engage with them?
No, I think all emotions are creative functioning. And actually, in the Buddhist tradition, they have a term for shame, which they think is a useful thing to have. They have two aspects to it, hiri and otapa. So if you feel shameful for yourself or in connection to the wider society. And they say it's kind of actually an ethical quality. So I think what we have to see that all, that it be pride could be confidence. Pride could be knowing I can do a good job. Or pride could be boasting myself and putting other people down. Or shame, I could have a funny feeling that I am a bad person, when actually I am not a bad person. So in a way, what the Buddha was looking at is, what is the intention? What is the action? What is the result of the action? And so, if we have pride, is it a pride which inspires us to do something? Or is it a pride which harm ourselves, harm other? If we have shame, is it because we think, oh, I made a mistake? Can I learn from my mistake? Or is it I feel such a bad, unpleasant feeling tone that it paralyzes me and that it really doesn't help me at all? So I think it's kind of like any emotion. Anger is the same. Anger is a creative function. Anger is something to make us act, actually. And so you can have righteous anger to help others out of compassion. But does a righteous anger is wise and compassionate? Or is it blind and make you act in a way which is harmful? So in a way, the question is more, what is the result? So it's kind of like sadness, I think, is very important to have that quality because it's a root of compassion. And also sadness for a loss makes us kind of go slower so we can take of ourselves and other better. All these are function. Fear, a very important function. So all these, that it be pride or shame or all these they're creative emotional function. And then the problem is when they become habituated, So they might not be connected to conditions, actually. Once I had this lady, and she was saying to me, I feel guilty all the time. And so I said, wait a minute. Do you actually feel guilty all the time? So notice when you don't feel guilty. How do you feel? And then she started to see, oh, that's true. I don't feel guilty all the time. Then I said, kind of notice when you feel the most guilty. And then she realized she only felt really guilty when she made one person. The rest of the time she did not feel it. But when she met that person, it was so intense that then it colored her for days. And then she felt, I feel guilty all the time, when actually it was just because she met that person for an hour. And so once she could say, oh yeah, this person, for whatever reason, makes me feel guilty, then she could try to creatively engage with that person. Or if we have made a mistake, of course, if we've made a mistake in the past, and we might have some regret, of course. But in a way, what is important, the regret will be humbling. What can I learn? How can I not do that again? But to be careful to have regret and be ashamed and think, oh, if only I had not done this, or if only I could change the past. We cannot change the past. In a way, we have to accept that we made mistake. And then shame, regret will be useful. What can I learn from this? How can I not do it again in this way? What will help me not to do it again in this way? And so I think it's kind of like to see the creative function of the emotion. And then as after seeing the pattern, what's a pattern? And in which way is it harmful? And how can I creatively engage with it?